This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We don't detect the infrared, so it comes right in through our eye lens, it goes into the retina, and it causes a minimal amount of damage at this distance. But that compounded damage from a 60 to 70 hour work week. And when you have, you know, 80% of the drivers filling out a form saying they have some sort of eye irritation or worse.
UPS drivers in Montana question the safety and health impacts of infrared cameras in their trucks.
And they would just tail vehicles, and in some of the families that I've spoken to, made up reasons to stop them. And then ICE was nearby to grab the non-citizen.
Memphis-based immigration attorney Andrew Rankin speaks about ICE tactics and SCOTUS updates.
We're trying to stop the slaughter of Palestinian people. And I think the most effective is when these dock workers refuse to load the ships.
Italian workers organize a general strike to stop the genocide in Palestine. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. The massive introduction of AI technology in the workplace is unregulated and threatens the lives and health and safety of millions of working people and the public. Montana Teamster and UPS line driver Eric Johnson began to question why he and other drivers were being subjected to infrared cameras in their cabs for up to 60 hours a week. He began to investigate and found that UPS and the Teamster leadership, including IBT President Sean O'Brien, were preventing any real investigation of the consequences of this AI technology in the trucks they drive. Eric Johnson spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
So how did you first come to question what was going on with these cameras that were being installed, and how were they installed? Was there any discussion with the membership about cameras or with the union?
No, there wasn't at all. It was pretty much just pushed them right in our face and started forward. No warning, no warning labels came with it, no instruction, no training, no anything. We turned to our local and, you know, they said about all we could do is file a grievance. And I wanted to file one right away because they were very annoying from the first moment they came into the trucks. They had all of these audible sounds and signals that just drove you crazy. Distracted driving, lens cap obstruction over and over again, 400, 500 times a day tell you this kind of stuff. And silliness, you know, I mean, just wasn't even accurate. I mean, I'm being blinded by the sun as I'm driving during daylight hours. And it's telling me I'm obstructing the lens cap because I'm using my visor to stop my face from being blinded. And as you can see, I'm wearing sunglasses. I have these infrared blocking sunglasses. I've grown accustomed to them because I've become quite photosensitive. I had surgery on my eye just recently, you know, not on my eye, but it damaged my eye because I had a tumor removed. Don't know if it's related to the cameras or not, but, you know, the possibility sticks in your mind because one of the concerns was with me was when I looked up what type of a tumor would grow like this and why. It said overexposure to radiation. And I don't work at a nuclear power plant. I drive here at UPS. It's a very low level radiation, but if you happen to be sensitive to it, it can harm you. So, you know, the genesis of it all, I have to give credit to a person that I've become really close friends with and an ally. His name is Tony Winters. He resides out of the Salt Lake area in local 222. And he said, you know, that technology they have in there, Eric, has infrared in it. And I said, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you ought to fight it from that direction. I said, well, you know, why don't you join me? He goes, I'll gladly join you because he tried to bring it up at a local union meeting. He was potted down. Bunch of nonsense about them using this in the medical community, so it must be safe. But if you look into any of that stuff with the medical community, they put on protective gear and protective eyewear. They limit the exposure time to mere minutes so it doesn't hurt you. And none of those precautions are given to us. So we went down this path. He wasn't going to have any headway with his local. We had great support out of our local, out of 190. We had Jim Sumas, our principal officer, and Darren Davis, our business agent, you know, fully get engaged with this. And they tried to help me every way I could in order to bring a thoughtful safety grievance on this. But we were fighting against all kinds of obstacles. The higher ups at the IBT just did not want to help us out. They wouldn't help us out with their industrial hygienist that they have employed. They wouldn't help us out with their safety committee or their technology committee. Barely got back to us, hardly responded to us, ignored us in many cases. And we were basically told that we didn't have a case. We just had to deal with this, and this was going to be the way it was going to be. And we reached out to everybody possible, and right up to the Sean O'Brien is definitely aware of this whole issue. And it's very disheartening to say that, but it's just the truth of the matter. So rank and file took it into their own hands, you know, a lot like, you know, what we're talking about with our fearless slate, having rank and file get involved and have power shift from the members on up. And we raised money. We did our investigating. We brought this camera to a laboratory in Peabody, Massachusetts, to International Lighting Technologies, one of the premier laboratories for testing the calibration of devices like this that use radiation. And we got all these results, and we brought them back, and we handed this back over to OSHA and actually to NIOSH. And there is current open investigations from both of those agencies right now that I believe is eventually going to assist us in our safety grievance, because NIOSH originally, we put in a HHE request, a hazardous health evaluation request with them prior to DOGE being implemented and cutting their funding. And they were scheduled to come out here to Montana and do an on-site test in these cameras, get a spectrometer reading and a radiance reading, find out just, you know, what we were looking at, you know, with these cameras. Since then, you know, they got defunded. They had to send us an email and tell us they could no longer investigate our situation and complaint. But they resumed it just recently when they got funding back. But now we're back to where we have the government shut down. So I just can't catch a break here. Otherwise, we'd already have an answer on this stuff, because we received an interesting letter from one of the top regional safety people with UPS. And it stated the most important part here to mention is that they claim they were following the IEC 62471 code, which is the reason they can have these in these trucks, which I will argue they are not following it. And they said that that these cameras did pose a low risk, a risk factor one instead of a risk factor zero, which is a low risk for radiation with this type of device, IR. It's basically being broadcasted on our face at about 863 nanometers, maxing out at 940 nanometers. At the distance, they say it's a low-level risk. But what they don't consider is, when you dig into the IEC, because like I said, we've been investigating this for 2+ years.
How many drivers are affected? I mean, UPS apparently has been installing these in trucks all over the country.
Yes. They're pretty much everywhere right now. We have literally, you know, thousands of drivers. If you look at Lidex, you know, which is the camera model, the 300 and the 400 SF series, they're approximately, to current date, installed, 2 million of them are installed in commercial trucks. And I think there's roughly, what, about 16 million drivers in North America. So it's a good chunk. And then there's all these other companies, and they all use a very similar technology. And this, you know, IR has lots of positive attributes to it, but not for long exposed times, and especially not to your eyes, because the human eye is very sensitive. We need them to drive. And when we're driving in a truck at night, and our pupils are dilated to 7 millimeters, and we're trying to see the road up ahead of us and soaking in all of that, trying to soak in every bit of ambient light to be able to see, we don't detect the infrared. So it comes right in through our eye lens, it goes into the retina, and it causes a minimal amount of damage at this distance. But that compounded damage from a 60 to 70 hour work week of 5 to 6 days a week for a 25 to 30 year career, you can have all these debilitating injuries and things that bring up, you know, increased risk factors are things like drivers filling out safety concern forms like they did in our case. And when you have, you know, 80% of the drivers filling out a form saying they have some sort of eye irritation or worse, I mean, you got to take this seriously and look into it further.
Well, isn't that what the union should be doing? If they have a health and safety department, doing surveys, finding out questionnaires to all the drivers at UPS, are you using this technology? Have you had any eye problems? Do you think that would be something that should be done by the union to protect its members, its drivers?
Absolutely. I mean, they should have done all this. They should have done the testing. Hey, this cost us $5,800 to get it tested. And we had to pass the hat around to probably, a group of maybe 10, 20 people that all chipped in that did this. And the Teamsters didn't have our backs on this. They didn't want to get to the bottom of it. I spoke to the head of the safety committee for the Teamsters, the head of the technology committee for the Teamsters. We had our union officials reach out to Teamster Industrial Hygienists, and they all blew us off.
What did they say?
Yes, they basically didn't return our calls or said they'd get back to us or that there was no real concern there. And meanwhile, yet I have countless people calling me, talking to me every day. Matter of fact, there's also another factor, and that could be anybody that is behind a wheel that takes an agent, which they like to put in the IEC 62471 fancy verbiage of concomitantly on agents while being exposed to infrared lighting. Well, that means medications and supplements. And when you look at a lot of the medications and supplements, there's about 136 different medications that are very quite common, you know, regular anti-inflammatories, ibuprofen, aspirin, all these kind of things, birth control, heart medicine, diabetes medicine, chemotherapy medicine, antifungals, antibiotics, and it'll give you warnings saying that, you know, you probably shouldn't be out in the sun because the sun not only does have UV rays, it also has infrared rays. And no one had ever planned that we'd have artificial infrared shining on our drivers both day and night in these type of commercial vehicles. And when these people are exposed to this, they could have all kinds of detrimental side effects, migraine, headaches, dizziness, fainting. These aren't conducive things for driving. Now, just the fact that the possibility of this exists, it should be enough that they should have never been installed in the first place. But they never educated us on any of this. They never told us about any of this. Now they're openly admitting that this has happened and there is a low-level risk. And no one's doing anything about it except for our small group, NIOSH, right now. And we're trying to get NIOSH to actually write a recommendation review and then submit that to OSHA to put it into law.
That was Montana Teamster and UPS truck driver Eric Johnson talking about his fight to protect himself and other members from being subjected to 60 hours or more of infrared cameras on their eyes while they do their jobs. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Remo Beats on the chat.
Hey, we going on strike. We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
For real.
Till they get this right.
Come on.
We going on strike.
On strike.
We going on strike.
All day.
We going on strike.
All night.
Till they get this right.
Look. Come on.
Going on strike, so you better listen. We ain't about to keep working under these conditions.
Facts.
Working in a hot plant with no air
conditioning.
And they got the nerve to tell us that this fair conditions.
Yeah, right.
They don't work they off, they gon' get fired.
Facts.
Temps working
working like slaves and don't get hired. The supervisor don't care if they get tired. They just trying to make sure themselves get hired. The union gotta stick together, do this for each other. Do this one for all my sisters, do this for our brothers. Cause they trying to treat us wrong, but they say they love us. We need a change right now, we ain't going further.
Yes.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
That was GMAC Cash on strike. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. In this next segment, I speak to Memphis-based immigration attorney Andrew Rankin about the legality of ICE tactics in the Trump era, recent SCOTUS rulings, legal partisanship, and more. This is part one of an interview taped on October 9th. Hello, Andrew, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me again on the program, Thomas. Good to be with you.
Likewise. I did interview you once before in March of this year, which was still the early days of the second Trump administration. What are your general thoughts on whether and how the Trump administration is navigating the legality of their campaign against immigrant workers?
So I think what's most troubling, I can take this many different ways, Thomas, but I think the tactic that is most troubling is they're not worrying or being concerned about whether it's legal or illegal. They're just doing it. And they're telling anyone who's displeased, come to court and fight about it. And then when a judge rules against the administration, they rail on that judge as an activist judge or a left-leaning judge or an extreme judge. How dare one single district court judge stand in front of the executive, including recently one of President Trump's own appointees from his first administration. Didn't like that either. So as it relates to immigrant workers, I think that is the entire tactic, is we're going to do what we want because we're the government. We're not worrying about whether it's legal. We'll deal with that in court if it comes up. So that's the way I'm taking your question. I could take it different ways, but that's the most troubling, because that is a little different from the first administration, where they didn't take as many extreme actions as they're taking now.
It's almost like, let's make as many fait accomplis as possible and let the dead be sorted out after the battle is over, right?
Pretty much. And I'm pretty sure their own attorneys have used the law of averages mentality, Thomas. If you go after enough people, enough employers, no matter how aggressive you do it, some will give up. Some will give you what you want without fighting. And if they can trim that fat off of their project, that's less work that they have to do. And then they're just left with the few people who do want to fight.
Yeah. Yeah. When we spoke before, we discussed the Trump administration's assault on birthright citizenship, as guaranteed explicitly by the 14th Amendment, as well as court precedents, especially the 19th century case Wong Kim Ark. SCOTUS ruled earlier this summer, but did not address specifically birthright citizenship, but it did greatly limit the discretionary powers of federal district judges to issue universal injunctions. Did this ruling surprise you, and what are your thoughts going forward?
Absolutely not. It did not surprise me. I am a close court watcher, and I frequently read concurrences and dissents, Thomas. And for the last several years, numerous justices have called into question, before the second Trump administration, the legality of a single district court judge issuing universal or nationwide injunctions. So for the court, as it's stacked today, to have ruled the way it did over the summer was not only unsurprising, but it was expected. I had been talking about it with my colleagues that even if Chief Justice Roberts, who is kind of turned into the moderate following Justice Kennedy's retirement, it would still be a 5-4 decision in favor of the more right-leaning justices. So that did not surprise me at all. As far as where we go from here, we are awaiting the justices' consideration of the merits of the case. Now, this is something that we talked about in March, whether the Supreme Court will actually rule on the merits of birthright citizenship. And the government has now gone back to the Supreme Court on a writ for on a petition for writ of certiorari, asking that the legality of the executive order be examined. And at that time, I'm going to stay, Thomas, on what I said, and I'll eat the crow if I have to, but I'm thinking the court stays out of it because the precedent is so clear. So that was what I said in March. I'm going to stick to it because the Supreme Court can get involved on questions of national importance. That's in the rules of the court that are on the Supreme Court's website. But if the precedent is clear, then perhaps the justices will not get involved because there's no reason to get involved. So I'm going to stick to my guns and say they stay out of it. But it's going to be probably a few months before we know that, because the petition was just filed and there are definitely going to be dozens upon dozens, maybe even hundreds of amicus briefs that are going to have to be reviewed and considered before the justices have their conference to discuss the case. And then no matter which way it goes, whether they accept the case, don't accept the case, the justices are probably going to write separate concurring and dissenting opinions. And that'll take even further for the ruling to come down. So I think in round three of our interview, if we do this again, it'll be interesting to see where we are, whether the justices take it up. But I'm going to say they stay out of it.
And indeed, what the substance of their ruling, their earlier ruling this summer, basically saying universal injunctions needed to stop, and that the recourse was class action. I have a question about a recent class action suit that's been filed here in the district a little bit later. But would you say that the rise of these injunctions sort of mirrors the rise in partisanship? And the rise, as we'll talk, my next question is about the shadow docket, but the rise of these particular vehicles for especially the executive branch to get a ruling one way or another in without having to wait very long.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's very partisan. I think, and we see that in a very striking way, Thomas. We see this in the venue that the party selects.
Yes.
Why do you think so many cases that led to universal injunctions during President Biden's term were filed in the central and northern districts of California? Why do you think that could be? Is because they knew that they were likely to get that result from any one of the judges who was assigned in that district. And then by the same token, why do you think the Trump administration so frequently files in one of the districts in Texas? Is because they know what they're going to get. So I think it is overly partisan, and it's easy to see that by their choice of venue.
The Ninth Circuit versus the Fourth or the Fifth Circuit, right?
Yeah. Correct. Yes, and well, that is
the Fifth is in New Orleans.
The Fifth is in New Orleans, and the Ninth is in the Ninth covers the West Coast. Mm-hmm. The Fifth covers Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi. District court judges in those partisan jurisdictions, but also, as you astutely noted, the law of the circuit leans in a very partisan direction. In the Ninth Circuit, it is extremely immigrant friendly. A little bit less, though, since the prior Trump administration tried to stack the Ninth Circuit with more right-leaning judges. But still, it's a very progressive circuit versus the Fifth Circuit, which is extremely conservative on these issues and often trades places with the Eighth as the most conservative immigration circuit in the nation. Depending on the issue, it's either the Fifth or the Eighth that has just tons and tons of negative precedent. And there's no surprise that the government that's looking for that type of ruling would find a way to get venue in one of those jurisdictions. And if that's not the definition of partisan, what the government's doing, I don't know what is.
We briefly discussed last time the SCOTUS shadow docket, whereby the court can and does make emergency or provisional rulings, often in a very opaque manner, without oral arguments, unsigned orders to lower courts, etc. What in your mind has been revealed by SCOTUS and the Trump government's use of these rulings and its incessant pleading that an emergency basis exists requiring SCOTUS to rule in this way?
Yeah, so that's the government's approach is these are legit avenues. These are legitimate. I mean, you can go to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis, but it goes back to who's on the court. They know which justices are likely to vote a certain way on certain issues. And I think you can make an analogy that the government is using the Supreme Court's shadow docket in the same way as the Trump administration has accused the prior Biden administration of overusing nationwide injunctions. They're using it to their own favor. But the problem with the downstream impact on everyday citizens is what you said. And not only is it opaque, but I'll add one other point. There's no rationale. There's no rationale explained. So you have these sensitive issues of national importance that are being decided with no rationale, no, as you said, no oral argument,
and unsigned by no judge puts his name on it.
No judge puts their name on it. And then these stay orders are lasting sometimes throughout the appellate process, which could be months and months and months. And then you have justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson dissenting in different groups or sometimes individually about this very thing, that we should exercise judicial restraint in issuing emergency orders and limiting those orders to truly exceptional circumstances. And without knowing the majority's rationale in issuing a stay order, it's hard to know what they found persuasive from the government's application. And I think the government taps into that. They don't need to attack one particular argument or a series of arguments. They just have to get something to stick, anything. And if you don't have oral argument, it's anybody's guess what actually persuaded them, because they don't explain it.
Yeah. Please discuss some of the more egregious and wantonly cruel ICE tactics, i.e. warrantless raids and arrests without clear probable cause on workplaces or community events, schools as well, traffic stops in jurisdictions where cops are allied with ICE policies and cooperating with their demands and thus arresting people that they stop at a checkpoint. In addition, masked, unidentified agents in military, paramilitary garb, raiding public parking lots at Home Depot, who, by the way, seem to allow this. And while you discuss this, also clarify the difference between reasonable cause and probable cause that supposedly pertains to ICE agents.
Yeah, so we'll start with the warrantless arrests. So for everyone to have the proper legal context, it's important to remember that there are two predicates that must, not might, not if the president wants, must be satisfied in every case. In order to make a warrantless arrest, the immigration officer has to satisfy two conditions. One is there has to be reasonable suspicion that the individual that is the subject of the warrantless arrest has committed an immigration violation, which last time I checked, you can't tell that by looking at their face. According to Justice Kavanaugh, you probably can. But according to everyday folk on the street, I don't see how you can tell. The second thing is, even if they have committed an immigration violation, they have to be likely to abscond before a warrant can be obtained. Only when those two criteria are satisfied may the immigration officer effect a warrantless arrest. I don't see how they're making individualized determinations in every single one of these cases when they do these mass arrests. I don't see how they can justify each and every single person that they have supposedly vetted and investigated for arrest. So this is where it gets egregious. So if I had to pick one, because I can go 95 different ways with this, probably the most egregious thing I've seen is using a child to get to a parent. That's probably the most egregious thing I've seen. I've seen a situation where the mother was the target. Now, we can debate whether it was appropriate because she did have several issues. She had some criminal issues. She had an outstanding removal order. But there are other ways to deal with that beyond that, that don't involve traumatizing a child, Thomas. And so what they did is they went to the child's school and they brought the child into a guidance counselor's office or principal's office or some similar location, and then contacted the mother and said, "We have federal agents here with your child. You need to come down to the school." And then when she came to the school, they arrested her there. So I think that's pretty egregious. Now, could I go other ways with this? Absolutely. But I think it's not nice to use adults in that way. But I think we can all agree. And this was an elementary school student. This was a fifth grader. So depending on when the child's birthday is, 9 to 11 years old, early birthday, late birthday, the child is no older than 11 if you're in the fifth grade. So I would say that's the most egregious thing I've seen. There were some close seconds and thirds, but I'm going with that one as the most egregious that I personally have seen. But as far as probable cause, reasonable suspicion, so probable cause is going to be a higher standard, Thomas, than reasonable suspicion. Where the exact line is, not even the Supreme Court has said, here's the line, here's the bright line, but reasonable suspicion from the cases I've researched, the cases I've argued, you need at least one thing, minimum, one thing on which to hang your hat. That's reasonable suspicion. So let's say for the sake of argument, that we have a person that the immigration officer knows is going to abscond. Let's assume in their investigation, this is a hypo, that the individual who is the target has had multiple arrests for fleeing the scene. So he's likely to abscond before they can get a warrant. Let's assume that's satisfied. So let's assume also that the individual has a name, common name, but it matches somebody in their database that is very similar looking to the target, and they're not really sure, but they think it's that person. If you put all that together, that's going to be something like reasonable suspicion to at least stop the person, to ask them what their status is, or to even potentially make an arrest. It's one factor, the photo, we could say, the photo judging what that person looks like versus what they're seeing on the street, that's going to be something like reasonable suspicion. Probable cause is not a guarantee by any stretch, but it's going to be higher than reasonable suspicion. You have to have something more than just a photo. You're going to have bio data. You're going to have maybe fingerprints. So the way I like to think about it is reasonable suspicion can be one factor, whereas probable cause probably is somewhere between three and five factors before a judge would find probable cause exists. And that's a lot easier for me than to try to parse out Supreme Court precedent where the justices themselves struggle with what probable cause is in a practical setting. Well, of course, and also you have to look at it from that perspective. If the federal government is saying, essentially, do what you want, why would local police feel that they're constrained? I mean, it's not something they should feel reprisals over. Well, I had reasonable suspicion. He was brown. That seems like a good enough suspicion for me. You think the federal government is going to say, oh, no, that was an incorrect assumption? They're going to say, no, we trust our local law enforcement partners. They don't make mistakes. They do above board work in every single circumstance. So when the federal government is encouraging these partnerships, there's no accountability. There's accountability on paper, but a lot of things look good on paper that just don't work in the real world. So, and I, you know, what you could also refer to when you mentioned Tennessee was the May 5th, 4th, 5th, 6th arrest between ICE and the Tennessee Highway Patrol. I'm not sure if you saw that, but what they did was they staged up in a heavily Hispanic area. Now, they're going to say high crime, whatever, guns. It was a high immigrant populated area. They didn't go to Brentwood, Tennessee, Thomas, where there is not a, where there are a certain kind of folk in that area. So they went to an area in Nashville where they knew there would be a lot of opportunity for immigration arrests. And it's not a coincidence that they picked that location. And they would just tail vehicles. And in some of the families that I've spoken to, made up reasons to stop them. And then ICE was nearby to grab the non-citizens. I spoke to numerous families in May who swore up one side, down the other. They had done nothing wrong. Their windows were not overly tinted. Their license plate was in view. The registration was current. The vehicle was insured. The driver was licensed. There were no outstanding wants or warrants for the owner of the vehicle.
Taillights were working.
Taillights were working. We could go on. And I heard at least a dozen of those same stories that there was no other justification for stopping the vehicle other than there was a Hispanic passenger. And I couldn't, in my own investigations, I couldn't see anything being done to just when I was taking some of these cases to dispute, because I didn't want to make false accusations. I don't want egg on my face. I did my own investigations and couldn't find anything to refute what these families were telling me, that this seemed to be a total profile event, at least as it relates to those families. And if it happened to those families, it surely happened to many others.
That was immigration attorney Andrew Rankin in Memphis, Tennessee, speaking about Trump's ICE legal strategy and tactics, recent Supreme Court rulings, and prospects for resistance. Part two of this interview will air on a future program.
A mi tierra, porque aquí no quepo yo. Quiero recordarle al gringo, yo no crucé la frontera me cruzó. América nació libre, el hombre la dividió. Brincara y me llaman invasor. Es un error bien marcado. Nos quitaron 8 estados. ¿Quién es aquí el invasor? Soy
That was Los Tigres del Norte, Somos Más Americanos. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Italian dock workers and hundreds of thousands of workers in Italy organized a general strike this past October 3rd to protest Israeli U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. Jack Heyman, a retired ILWU Local 10 longshore worker, joined dock workers meeting in Genova, Italy, to discuss European dockers' plans to stop the genocide in Gaza by blocking all military cargo from European ports to Israel. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
This was a conference of European dock workers, and specifically those in the Mediterranean. And that's where the shipping comes into Israel. That's the main source, the Mediterranean. Of course, it comes in through the Red Sea also, but the Houthis have blocked that off effectively. The port of Elan is not used because of the attacks by the Yemeni forces. So these were longshoremen, or they call them dock workers. It's only in this country that we use the expression longshore. But the dock workers there were from Greece, Italy, Spain, Cyprus, Germany, Turkey, and Morocco were not present, but they sent statements. So the first day of the conference was the 26th, Friday, for the European dock workers only. And then it opened up the next day with other speakers, including a speaker from a new trade union formation there, called the New Palestinian Federal Union. And he spoke for quite a while, and it was very inspiring to all of us there. So they came away with a program that they all voted on Friday, which I believe will be implemented. There was a lot of serious, robust discussion, and they announced that there will be a program basically around the principle of stopping military cargo to Israel. You may know this, that at last year's ILWU Longshore Convention in Vancouver, Canada, we in Local 10 submitted a resolution to refuse to handle military cargo for the war in Gaza and the West Bank, committed by the genocidist Israeli forces. So this is something that we're familiar with. The problem is that it was defeated actually at our convention, because the international leadership took no open position on it, but everyone knew that they were opposed to it. And basically it went down in defeat. Local 10 still holds its position that we're opposed to loading military cargo for Israel for this genocidal war.
And the actions of port workers in Europe has encouraged people around the world that direct action is being taken. Why is it important that labor, dock workers and workers, shut this down? Why is that critical, in fact?
Well, there have been many different strategies used to try to stop this Gaza war. As you know, the flotilla, the global Sumud flotilla, had a lot of publicity around it. It's just recently been intercepted by the Israeli occupation forces. And that was one strategy. I think that was more symbolic than anything else, because while there's a famine going on there and they're in dire need of medical supplies and they were being carried by the flotilla, I think we knew in advance that the Israelis were going to stop them. They did in 2010 when the Mavi Marmara flotilla was going to Gaza. And in that case, they murdered 10 of the humanitarian aid workers. So that's one way people are trying to break the Israeli occupation and massacre and through starvation and bombing of the Palestinian population. So the other way is they're calling on their governments to take action. But that's not going to happen in Western Europe, the NATO powers. The U.S. is the main backer of the Zionist entity. And behind them stands Germany, France, the U.K. And while they have called for self-determination for Palestine, most of those Western European countries, they keep supplying Israel with military cargo. That's hypocritical to the highest degree. And the way to really stop it is to stop that military cargo from going. And the dock workers around the world are at the nexus point where the shipping of this cargo goes. Not only by ships, it's mainly by ships, but also as the Palestinian youth movement found here in the Bay Area, while the dock workers are refusing to load military cargo, the PYM found out that the Oakland airport is being used to ship cargo on a daily basis. So there are different strategies for trying to stop the slaughter of Palestinian people. And I think the most effective is when these dock workers refuse to load the ships. And this happened during our conference, actually, the second day of our conference, which was, I think, the 27th, while we were in session, there was a protest against the slaughter of Palestinians and the protesting cargo being shipped to Israel, war cargo. And CALP, C-A-L-P, one of the unions, one of the more militant unions in Italy, was marching with a lot of the youth in the city when they found out that there was the ZIM New Zealand coming in to pick up 10 containers. This is in the port of Genoa, coming in to pick up 10 containers going to Israel. And the CALP dock workers split off from the demonstration and took a couple hundred of the demonstrators with them. And the Israeli ship, the ZIM New Zealand, was forced to leave without loading any of the military cargo. That's how you effectively stop the Israeli forces from massacring Palestinian people by depriving them of the weaponry they need to commit these massacres, a deformed workers' state.
And there have been brutal and frontal attacks on federal workers. 700,000 federal workers had their union rights taken away. They're destroying the NLRB. And now the government is shutting down and they're bringing in one of the directors who wants to implement Project 2025, get rid of hundreds of thousands of workers. In the midst of that, the United States, it looks like, is preparing for an invasion of Venezuela. They position troops in Puerto Rico and they're blowing ships out of the water near Venezuela. It seems that this adventurous U.S. imperialist policy is actually expanding in the midst of this economic crisis in the United States.
Yeah, I think what Trump is doing is trying to show that the U.S., which is clearly in decline economically and militarily, is still a dominant power to be dealt with. I think they've tried before to undermine and overthrow the Venezuela government. I think ultimately what they want to do is the thorn in their side is Cuba, which had a revolution and, it's still a worker state, a deformed worker state, but it poses a threat, according to Marco Rubio. And so I think, yes, they're indiscriminately just bombing boats off the shore of Venezuela. There's a reaction to that because Brazil is a little bit more independent than some of the other South American and Central American countries. They're part of the BRICS. So There could be a serious confrontation. The governments in South America are real on. They're keeping their eye on what's happening in Venezuela, because what the United States is doing, trying to maintain its control over the Western Hemisphere through the Monroe Doctrine, is a threat to every country in the Western Hemisphere. I think Colombia sees that. I know Brazil does for sure. And Venezuela is mobilizing its forces in anticipation of an invasion. You know, Trump is kind of bonkers when it comes to the military. And I think this meeting of all the generals and admirals was so bizarre. It never happened in U.S. history before. But I think he's trying to line up the military, not just for invasions against Venezuela, but also domestically. He's saying the enemy is within, landing helicopters on a building in Chicago and raiding people, arresting people. He's got a war going on many, many fronts, and Venezuela is one of them.
And it seems like the union bureaucracy, the trade unions, despite the threat of martial law, the military attacks on cities, is completely silent. They're not really rallying members of the unions to prepare for military occupations of cities, much less U.S. invasions of Venezuela and the role of the United States now internationally military, in a military fashion. I mean, politically, the Democrats, of course, have supported these wars. And not only the Democrats, but the AFL-CIO leadership have supported, through the Solidarity Center, the attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela, funding opposition and supporting that. I mean, it seems like the structure, the AFL-CIO structure, actually is, you know, a part of U.S. intervention internationally.
Well, yeah, that's what I was trying to say before. There's a growing together of the trade union bureaucracy with the state. You know, before this Solidarity Center, there was AFLD, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, you know, headed up by Lovestone and Brown, two CIA agents trying to overthrow, or not trying to, helping to overthrow the government in Chile, the military dictatorship that was established in Argentina. This is Nicaragua, El Salvador. All these conflagrations are based on the U.S. attempting to maintain its dominance in the Western Hemisphere. The trade union movement needs to step up. And, you know, what we really need to do is use the power that we have. These federal workers that are like going to the slaughterhouse like lambs, like sheep, without a fight, it's incredible that the leadership just accepts all these cuts. There should have been a strike. And then besides the federal workers going out on strike, all the workers, we should have a general strike in this country over hundreds of thousands of federal workers being fired. But the trade union bureaucracy is actually complicit. They have no strategy, either the Democrats or the Republicans, for fighting these kinds of attacks on the working class. That's why I've always been in favor of a workers' party, a class struggle workers' party that would mobilize workers against attacks like these. It's sorely needed today to have an independent party of the working class.
That was retired ILWU Local 10 unionist Jack Heyman reporting on the Italian general strike and dock workers' action to stop all cargo to Israel. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.